Berger's life had been filled with meetings and work around the clock from the minute she stepped into Miranda's shoes. It was not until Wednesday night, almost 2 weeks after Blomqvist had given her Cortez's research papers on Borgshu, that she had time to address the issue. As she opened the file, she realized that her procrastination also had to do with the fact that she didn't really want to deal with the problem. She already knew that calamity was inevitable. She arrived home in Saltschubaden at 7, unusually early, and it was only when she had to turn off the alarm in the hall that she remembered her husband was away. She had given him an especially long kiss that morning because he was flying to Paris to give some lectures and wouldn't go back until the weekend. She had no idea where he was giving the lectures or what they were about. She went upstairs, ran a bath, and undressed. She took Cortez's folder with her and spent the next half hour reading through the whole story. She couldn't help but smile. The boy was going to be a formidable reporter. He was 26 years old and had been at Millennium for 4 years, right out of journalism school. She felt a certain pride. The story had Millennium's stamp on it from beginning to end. Every T was crossed, every I dotted. But she also felt tremendously depressed. Borgshu was a good man, and she liked him. He was soft-spoken, sharp-witted, and charming, and he seemed unconcerned with prestige. Besides, he was her employer. How the hell could he have been so fucking stupid? She wondered whether there might be another explanation or some mitigating circumstances. But she already knew it would be impossible to explain this away. She put the folder on the windowsill and stretched out in the bath to ponder the situation. Millennium was going to publish the story, no question. If she had still been there, she wouldn't have hesitated. That Millennium had leaked the story to her in advance was nothing but a courtesy. They wanted to reduce the damage to her personally. If the situation had been reversed, if SMP had made some damaging discovery about Millennium's chairman of the board, which happened to be her, they wouldn't have hesitated either. Publication would be a serious blow to Borgshu. The damaging thing was not that his company, Vitavara Inc., had imported goods from a company on the United Nations blacklist of companies using child labour, and in this case slave labour too, in the form of convicts, undoubtedly some of them political prisoners. The really damaging thing was that Borgshu knew about all this and still went on ordering toilets from Fongsu Industries. It was a mark of the sort of greed that did not go down well with the Swedish people in the wake of the revelations about other criminal capitalists, such as Skandia's former president. Borgshu would naturally claim that he did not know about the conditions at Fongsu, but Cortez had solid evidence. If Borgshu took that tack, he would be exposed as a liar. In June 1997, Borgshu had gone to Vietnam to sign the first contracts. He had spent 10 days there on that occasion, and toured the company's factories. If he claimed not to have known that many of the workers there were only 12 or 13 years old, he would look like an idiot. Cortez had demonstrated that in 2001 the UN Commission on Child Labour had added Fongsu Industries to its list of companies that exploit child labour, and that this had then been the subject of magazine articles. Two organisations against child labour, one of them the globally recognised International Joint Effort Against Child Labour in London, had written letters to companies that had placed orders with Fongsu. 7 letters had been sent to Vitavara Inc., and 2 of those were addressed to Borgshu personally. The organisation in London had been very willing to supply the evidence, and Vitavara Inc. had not replied to any of the letters. Worse still, Borgshu went to Vietnam twice more, in 2001 and 2004, to renew the contracts. This was the coup de grace. It would be impossible for Borgshu to claim ignorance. The inevitable media storm could lead to only one thing. If Borgshu was smart, he would apologize and resign from his positions on various boards. If he decided to fight, he would be annihilated. Berger did not care if Borgshu was or was not chairman of the board of Vitavara Inc. What mattered to her was that he was the CEO of SMP. At a time when the newspaper was on the edge and a campaign of rejuvenation was underway, SMP could not afford to keep him. Berger's decision was made. She would go to Borgshu, show him the document, and thereby hope to persuade him to resign before the story was published. If he dug in his heels, she would call an emergency board meeting, explain the situation, and force the board to dismiss Borgshu. And if they did not, she would have to resign, effective immediately. She had been thinking for so long that the bathwater was now cold. She showered and toweled herself off and went to the bedroom to put on a bathrobe. Then she picked up her mobile and called Blomqvist. No answer. She went downstairs to put on some coffee, and for the first time since she had started at SMP, she looked to see whether there was a film on TV that she could watch to relax. As she walked into the living room, she felt a sharp pain in her foot. She looked down and saw blood. She took another step, and pain shot through her entire foot. She had to hop over to an antique chair to sit down. She lifted her foot and saw to her dismay that a shard of glass had pierced her heel. At first she felt faint. Then she steeled herself and took hold of the shard and pulled it out. The pain was appalling, and blood gushed from the wound. She pulled open a drawer in the hall where she kept scarves, gloves, and hats. She found a scarf and wrapped it around her foot and tied it tight. That was not going to be enough, so she reinforced it with another improvised bandage. The bleeding had apparently subsided. She looked at the bloodied piece of glass in amazement. How did this get here? Then she discovered more glass on the hall floor. Jesus Christ. She looked into the living room and saw that the picture window was shattered and the floor was covered in glass. She went back to the front door and put on the outdoor shoes she had kicked off as she came home. That is, she put on one shoe and stuck the toes of her injured foot into the other and hopped into the living room to take stock of the damage. Then she found the brick in the middle of the living room floor. She limped over to the balcony door and went out to the garden. Someone had sprayed in 3-foot-high letters on the back wall. Whore. It was just after 9 in the evening when Figueroa held the car door open for Blomqvist. She went around the car and got into the driver's seat.
Should I drive you home, or do you want to be dropped off somewhere?
Blomqvist stared straight ahead.
I haven't got my bearings yet, to be honest. I've never had a confrontation with a Prime Minister before.
Figueroa laughed.
You played your cards very well, she said. I would never have guessed you were such a good poker player.
I meant every word.
Of course. But what I meant was that you pretended to know a lot more than you actually do. I realized that when I worked out how you identified me.
Blomqvist turned and looked at her profile.
You wrote down my car registration when I was parked on the hill outside your building. You made it sound as if you knew what was being discussed at the Prime Minister's secretariat.
Why didn't you say anything? Blomqvist said.
She gave him a quick look and turned on to Grev Turgaten.
The rules of the game. I shouldn't have picked that spot, but there wasn't anywhere else to park. You keep a sharp eye on your surroundings, don't you?
You were sitting with a map spread out on the front seat, talking on the phone. I took down your registration and ran a routine check. I check out every car that catches my attention. I usually draw a blank. In your case, I discovered that you worked for Seppo.
I was following Mortensen.
Aha! So simple.
Then I discovered that you were tailing him using Suzanne Linder and Milton Security.
Armansky's detailed her to keep an eye on what goes on around my apartment.
And since she went into your building, I assume that Milton has put in some sort of hidden surveillance of your apartment.
That's right. We have an excellent film of how they break in and go through my papers. Mortensen carries a portable photocopier with him. Have you identified Mortensen's sidekick?
He's unimportant. A locksmith with a criminal record who's probably being paid to open your door.
Name?
Protected source?
Naturally.
Lars Falsen, 47, alias Fallon. Convicted of safe-cracking in the '80s and some other minor stuff. Has a shop at Nordtol.
Thanks.
But let's save the secrets till we meet again tomorrow.
The meeting had ended with an agreement that Blomqvist would come to constitutional protection the next day to set in motion an exchange of information. Blomqvist was thinking. They were just passing Sergelstorg in the city centre.
You know what? I'm incredibly hungry. I had a late lunch and was going to make some pasta when I got home, but I was waylaid by you. Have you eaten?
A while ago.
Take us to a restaurant where we can get some decent food.
All food is decent.
He looked at her.
I thought you were a health food fanatic.
No, I'm a workout fanatic. If you work out, you can eat whatever you want. Within reason.
She braked at the Klaraberg viaduct and considered the options. Instead of turning down towards Södermalm, she kept going straight to Kungsholmen.
I don't know what the restaurants are like in Söder, but I know an excellent Bosnian place at Fridhemsplan. Their burek is fantastic.
Sounds good, Blomqvist said.
Salander tapped her way, letter by letter, through her report. She had worked an average of 5 hours each day. She was careful to express herself precisely. She left out all the details that could be used against her. That she was locked up had turned out to be a blessing. She always had plenty of warning to put away her palm when she heard the rattling of a key ring or a key being put in the lock.
I was about to lock up Bureman's cabin outside Stella Holmen when Carl Magnus Lundin and Sonny Niemannen arrived on motorbikes. Since they had been searching for me in vain for a while on behalf of Zalachenko and Niedermann, they were surprised to see me there. Magga Lundin got off his motorbike and declared, "I think the dyke needs some cock." Both he and Niemannen acted so threatening that I had no choice but to resort to my right of self-defence. I left the scene on Lundin's motorbike, which I then abandoned at the shopping centre in Elshire.
There was no reason to volunteer the information that Lundin had called her a whore, or that she had bent down and picked up Niemannen's P-83 Vanad and punished Lundin by shooting him in the foot. The police could probably work that out for themselves, but it was up to them to prove it. She did not intend to make their job any easier by confessing to something that would lead to a prison sentence. The text had grown to 33 pages, and she was nearing the end. In some sections, she was particularly reticent about details and went to a lot of trouble not to supply any evidence that could back up in any way the many claims she was making. She went so far as to obscure some obvious evidence and instead moved on to the next link in the chain of events. She scrawled back and read through a section where she told how Advocate Bureman had violently and sadistically raped her. That was the part she had spent the most time on, and one of the few she had rewritten several times before she was satisfied. The section took up 19 lines in her account. She reported in a matter-of-fact manner how he had hit her, thrown her onto her stomach on the bed, taped her mouth, and handcuffed her. She then related how he had repeatedly committed acts of sexual violence against her, including anal penetration. She went on to report how at one point during the rape he had wound a piece of clothing, her own T-shirt, around her neck, and strangled her for such a long time that she temporarily lost consciousness. Then there were several lines where she identified the implements he had used during the rape, which included a short whip, an anal plug, a rough dildo, and clamps which he attached to her nipples. She frowned and studied the text. At last she raised the stylus and tapped out a few more lines of text.
"On one occasion, when I still had my mouth taped shut, Bureman commented on the fact that I had several tattoos and piercings, including a ring in my left nipple. He asked if I liked being pierced, and then left the room. He came back with a needle, which he pushed through my right nipple."
The matter-of-fact tone gave the text such a surreal touch that it sounded like an absurd fantasy. The story simply did not sound credible. That was her intention. At that moment she heard the rattle of the guard's keyring. She turned off the palm at once and put it in the recess at the back of the bedside table. It was Giannini. She frowned. It was 9 in the evening, and Giannini did not usually appear this late.
"Hello, Elizabeth. Hello. How are you feeling?" "I'm not finished yet."
Giannini sighed.
"Elizabeth, they've set the trial date for July 13th. "That's okay." "No, it's not okay. Time is running out, and you're not telling me anything. I'm beginning to think that I made a colossal mistake taking this job. If we're going to have the slightest chance, you have to trust me. We have to work together."
Salander studied her for a moment. Finally, she leaned her head back and looked up at the ceiling.
"I know what we're supposed to be doing. I understand Mikhail's plan, and he's right. I'm not so sure about that. But I am. The police want to interrogate you again. A detective named Hans Faster from Stockholm. Let him interrogate me. I won't say a word. You have to hand in a statement."
Salander gave Giannini a sharp look.
"I repeat, I won't say a word to the police. When we get to the courtroom, the prosecutor won't have a single syllable from any interrogation to fall back on. All they'll have is the statement that I'm composing now, large parts of which will seem preposterous. And they're going to get it a few days before the trial."
"So, when are you actually going to sit down with a pen and paper and write this statement?"
"You'll have it in a few days, but it can't go to the prosecutor until just before the trial."
Giannini looked sceptical. Salander suddenly gave her a cautious smile.
"You talk about trust. Can I trust you?"
"Of course you can."
"Okay. Could you smuggle me in a handheld computer so that I can keep in touch with people online?"
"No, of course not.
If it were discovered, I'd be charged with a crime and lose my license to practice. But if someone else got one in, would you report it to the police?"
Giannini raised her eyebrows.
If I didn't know about it.
But if you did know about it, what would you do?
I'd shut my eyes.
How about that?
This hypothetical computer is soon going to send you a hypothetical email. When you've read it, I want you to come again.
Lisbeth,
wait. It's like this. The prosecutor is dealing with a marked deck. I'm at a disadvantage no matter what I do, and the purpose of the trial is to get me committed to a secure psychiatric ward.
I know.
If I'm going to survive, I have to fight dirty.
Finally, Giannini nodded.
When you came to see me the first time, Salander said, you had a message from Blomqvist. He said that he'd told you almost everything with a few exceptions. One of those exceptions had to do with the skills he discovered I had when we were in Hedestad.
That's correct.
He was referring to the fact that I'm extremely good with computers. So good that I can read and copy what's on Ekstrom's machine.
Giannini went pale.
You can't be involved in this, and you can't use any of that material at the trial, Salander said.
You're right about that.
So you know nothing about it.
Okay.
But someone else, your brother, let's say, could publish selected excerpts from it. You'll have to think about this possibility when you plan your strategy.
I understand.
Annika, this trial is going to turn on who uses the toughest methods.
I know.
I'm happy to have you as my lawyer. I trust you and I need your help. But if you get difficult about the fact that I'm going to use unethical methods, then we'll lose the trial.
Right.
And if that were the case, I need to know now. I'd have to get myself a new lawyer.
Lisbeth, I can't break the law.
You don't have to break any law. But you do have to shut your eyes to the fact that I am. Can you manage that?
Salander waited patiently for almost a minute before Annika nodded.
Good. Let me tell you the main points that I'm going to put in my statement.
Figueroa had been right. The Burek was fantastic. Blomqvist studied her carefully as she came back from the ladies. She moved as gracefully as a ballerina, but she had a body like... Blomqvist could not help being fascinated. He repressed an impulse to reach out and feel her leg muscles.
How long have you been working out? He said.
Since I was a teenager.
And how many hours a week do you do it?
2 hours a day, sometimes three.
Why?
I mean, I understand why people work out, but...
You think it's excessive?
I'm not sure exactly what I think. She smiled and did not seem at all irritated by his questions.
Maybe you're just bothered by seeing a woman with muscles. Do you think it's a turn-off or unfeminine?
No, not at all. It suits you somehow. You're very sexy. She laughed.
I'm cutting back on the training now. 10 years ago I was doing rock-hard bodybuilding. It was cool. But now I have to be careful that the muscles don't turn to fat. I don't want to get flabby. So I lift weights once a week and spend the rest of the time doing some cross-training, or running, playing badminton, or swimming, that sort of thing. It's exercise more than hard training.
I see.
The reason I work out is that it feels great. That's a normal phenomenon among people who do extreme training. The body produces a pain-suppressing chemical and you become addicted to it. If you don't run every day, you get withdrawal symptoms after a while. You feel an enormous sense of well-being when you give something your all. It's almost as powerful as good sex.
Blomqvist laughed.
You should start working out yourself, she said. You're getting a little thick in the waist.
I know, he said. I have a constant guilty conscience. Sometimes I start running regularly and lose a few pounds. Then I get involved in something and don't get time to do it again for a month or two.
You've been pretty busy these last few months. I've been reading a lot about you. You beat the police by several lengths when you tracked down Zalachenko and identified Niedermann.
Lisbeth Salander was faster.
How did you find out Niedermann was in Gossenberger?
Blomqvist shrugged. Routine research. I wasn't the one who found him. It was our managing editor. Well, now our editor-in-chief, Malin Eriksson, who managed to dig him up through the corporate records. He was on the board of Zalachenko's company, KAB Import.
That simple.
And why did you become a SEPO activist? He said.
Believe it or not, I'm something as old-fashioned as a Democrat. I mean, the police are necessary, and a democracy needs a political safeguard. That's why I'm proud to be working at constitutional protection.
Is it really something to be proud of? Said Blomqvist.
You don't like the security police?
I don't like institutions that are beyond normal parliamentary scrutiny. It's an invitation to abuse of power, no matter how noble the intentions.
Why are you so interested in the religion of antiquity?
Figueroa looked at Blomqvist.
You were reading a book about it on my staircase, he said.
The subject fascinates me.
I see.
I'm interested in a lot of things. I've studied law and political science while I've worked for the police. Before that, I studied both philosophy and the history of ideas.
Do you have any weaknesses?
I don't read fiction. I never go to the cinema. And I watch only the news on TV. How about you? Why did you become a journalist?
Because there are institutions like SEPO that lack parliamentary oversight, which have to be exposed from time to time. I don't really know. I suppose my answer to that is the same one you gave me. I believe in a constitutional democracy, and sometimes it has to be protected.
The way you did with Hans-Erik Wennerström?
Something like that.
You're not married. Are you and Erika Berger together?
Erika Berger's married.
So all the rumours about you two are nonsense. Do you have a girlfriend?
No one's steady.
So the rumours might be true after all.
Blomqvist smiled.
Malin Eriksson worked at her kitchen table at home in Årsta until the small hours. She sat bent over spreadsheets of Millennium's budget and was so engrossed that Anton, her boyfriend, eventually gave up trying to have a conversation with her. He washed the dishes, made a late snack, and put on some coffee. Then he left her in peace and sat down to watch a repeat of CSI. Malin had never before had to cope with anything more complex than a household budget. But she had worked alongside Berger balancing the monthly books, and she understood the principles. Now she was suddenly editor-in-chief, and with that role came responsibility for the budget. Sometime after midnight she decided that, whatever happened, she was going to have to get an accountant to help her. Ingela Oskarsson, who did the bookkeeping 2 days a week, had no responsibility for the budget, and was not at all helpful when it came to making decisions about how much a freelancer should be paid, or whether they could afford to buy a new laser printer that was not already included in the sum earmarked for capital investments or IT upgrades. It was a ridiculous situation. Millennium was making a profit, but that was because Berger had always managed to balance an extremely tight budget. Instead of investing in something as fundamental as a new colour laser printer for 45,000 kroner, they would have to settle for a black-and-white printer for 8,000 instead. For a moment she envied Berger. At SMP she had a budget in which such a cost would be considered pin money. Millennium's financial situation had been healthy at the last annual general meeting, but the surplus in the budget was primarily made up of the profits from Blomqvist's book about the Wennerström affair. The revenue that had been set aside for investment was shrinking alarmingly fast. One reason for this was the expenses incurred by Blomqvist in connection with the Salander story. Millennium did not have the resources to keep any employee on an open-ended budget with all sorts of expenses in the form of rental cars, hotel rooms, taxes, the purchase of research material, and new mobiles and the like. Eriksson signed an invoice from Daniel Olsson in Göteborg. She sighed. Blomqvist had approved a sum of 14,000 kroner for a week's research on a story that was not going to be published. Payment to an Idris Gidi went into the budget under fees to sources who could not be named, which meant that the accountant would remonstrate about the lack of an invoice or receipt and insist that the matter have the board's approval. Millennium had paid a fee to advocate Giannini, which was supposed to come out of the general fund, but she had also invoiced Millennium for train tickets and other costs. Eriksson put down her pen and looked at the totals. Blomqvist had blown 150,000 kroner on the Salander story, way beyond their budget. Things could not go on this way. She was going to have a talk with him. Berger spent the evening not on her sofa watching TV, but in the ER at Nacka Hospital. The shard of glass had penetrated so deeply that the bleeding would not stop. It turned out that one piece had broken off and was still in her heel and would have to be removed. She was given a local anaesthetic and the wound was sewn up with 3 stitches. Berger cursed the whole time she was at the hospital, and she kept trying to call her husband, or Blomqvist. Neither chose to answer the phone. By 10 she had her foot wrapped in a thick bandage. She was given crutches and took a taxi home. She spent a while limping around the living room, sweeping up the floor. She called emergency glass to order a new window. She was in luck. It had been a quiet evening, and they arrived within 20 minutes. But the living room window was so big that they did not have the glass in stock. The glazier offered to board up the window with plywood for the time being, and she accepted gratefully. As the plywood was being put up,
She called the duty officer at Naka Integrated Protection and asked why the hell their expensive burglar alarm had not gone off when someone threw a brick through her biggest window. Someone from NIP came out to look at the damage. It turned out that whoever had installed the alarm several years before had neglected to connect the leads from the windows in the living room. Berger was furious. The man from NIP said they would fix it first thing in the morning. Berger told him not to bother. Instead, she called the duty officer at Milton Security and explained her situation. She said that she wanted to have a complete alarm package installed the next morning. "I know I have to sign a contract, but tell Armansky that Erika Berger called and make damn sure someone comes around in the morning." Then, finally, she called the police. She was told that there was no car available to come and take her statement. She was advised to contact her local station in the morning.
"Thank you. Fuck off."
Then she sat and fumed for a long time until her adrenaline level dropped, and it began to sink in that she was going to have to sleep alone in a house without an alarm while somebody was running around the neighborhood calling her a whore and smashing her windows. She wondered whether she ought to go into the city to spend the night at a hotel, but Berger was not the kind of person who liked to be threatened, and she liked giving in to threats even less. But she did take some elementary safety precautions. Blomqvist had told her once how Salander had put pay to the serial killer Martin Wanger with a golf club. So she went to the garage and spent several minutes looking for her golf bag, which she had hardly even thought about for 15 years. She chose an iron that she thought had a certain heft to it and laid it within easy reach of her bed. She left a putter in the hall and an 8-iron in the kitchen. She took a hammer from the toolbox in the basement and put that in the master bedroom. She put the canister of mace from her shoulder bag on her bedside table. Finally, she found a rubber doorstop and wedged it under the bedroom door. And then she almost hoped that the moron who had called her a whore and destroyed her window would be stupid enough to come back that night. By the time she felt sufficiently entrenched, it was 1. She had to be at SMP at 8. She checked her calendar and saw that she had 4 meetings, the first at 10. Her foot was aching badly. She undressed and crept into bed. Then, inevitably, she lay awake and worried. Whore. She had received 9 emails, all of which had contained the word whore, and they all seemed to come from sources in the media. The first had come from her own newsroom, but the source was a fake. She got out of bed and took out the new Dell laptop that she had been given when she had started at SMP. The first email, which was also the most crude and intimidating, with its suggestion that she would be fucked with a screwdriver, had come on May 16th, a couple of weeks ago. Email number 2 had arrived 2 days later on May 18th. Then a week went by before the emails started coming again, now at intervals of about 24 hours. Then the attack on her home. Again. Whore. During that time, Carlson on the culture pages had received an ugly email purportedly sent by Berger. And if Carlson had received an email like that, it was entirely possible that the emailer had been busy elsewhere too, that other people had gotten mail apparently from her that she did not know about. It was an unpleasant thought. The most disturbing was the attack on her house. Someone had taken the trouble to find out where she lived, drive out here, and throw a brick through the window. It was obviously premeditated. The attacker had brought his can of spray paint. The next moment she froze when she realized that she could add another attack to the list. All 4 of her tires had been slashed when she spent the night with Blomqvist at the Slusen Hilton. The conclusion was just as unpleasant as it was obvious. She was being stalked. Someone, for some unknown reason, had decided to harass her. The fact that her home had been subject to an attack was understandable. It was where it was and impossible to disguise. But if her car had been damaged on some random street in Södermalm, her stalker must have been somewhere nearby when she parked it. He must have been following her. Chapter 18. Thursday, June 2nd. Berger's mobile was ringing. It was 9:05.
"Good morning, Fru Berger. Dragan Armansky. I understand you called last night."
Berger explained what had happened and asked whether Milton Security could take over the contract from Naka Integrated Protection.
"We can certainly install an alarm that will work," Armansky said. "The problem is that the closest car we have at night is in Naka Center. Response time would be about 30 minutes. If we took the job, I'd have to subcontract out your house. We have an agreement with a local security company, Adam Security in Fisksetra, which has a response time of 10 minutes if all goes as it should.
That would be an improvement over NIP, which doesn't bother to turn up at all.
Adam Security is a family-owned business, a father, two sons, and a couple of cousins. Greeks, good people. I've known the father for many years. They handle coverage about 320 days a year. They tell us in advance the days they aren't available because of holidays or something else, and then our car in Naka takes over.
That works for me.
I'll be sending a man out this morning. His name is David Rosin, and in fact he's already on his way. He's going to do a security assessment. He needs your keys if you're not going to be home, and he needs your authorization to do a thorough examination of your house from top to bottom. He's going to take pictures of the entire property and the immediate surroundings.
All right.
Rosin has a lot of experience, and we'll make you a proposal. We'll have a complete security plan ready in a few days, which will include a personal attack alarm, fire security, evacuation plan, and break-in protection.
Okay.
If anything should happen, we also want you to know what to do in the 10 minutes before the car arrives from Fisksetra.
Sounds good.
We'll install the alarm this afternoon, then we'll have to sign a contract.
Only after she had finished her conversation with Armansky did Berger realize that she had overslept. She called Fredrickson and explained that she had hurt herself. He would have to cancel the 10 o'clock.
"What's happened?" he said.
"I cut my foot," Berger said. "I'll hobble in as soon as I've pulled myself together."
She used the toilet in the master bathroom and then pulled on some black pants and borrowed one of Gregor's slippers for her injured foot. She chose a black blouse and put on a jacket. Before she removed the doorstop from the bedroom door, she armed herself with a canister of mace. She made her way cautiously through the house and switched on the coffee maker. She had her breakfast at the breakfast table, listening for sounds in the vicinity. She had just poured a second cup of coffee when there was a firm knock on the front door. It was David Rosin from Milton Security. Figueroa walked to Bergsgarten and summoned her four colleagues for an early morning conference.
"We have a deadline now," she said. "Our work has to be done by July 13th, the day the Salander trial begins. We have just under 6 weeks. Let's agree on what's most important right now. Who wants to go first?"
Berglund cleared his throat.
"That blonde man with Mortensen. Who is he?"
"We have photographs, but no idea how to find him. We can't put out an APB.
"What about Goldberg, then? There must be a story to track down there. We have him in the security police from the early 50s to 1964, when SIS was founded. Then he vanishes."
Figueroa nodded.
"Should we conclude that the Zalachenko Club was an association formed in 1964? That will be some time before Zalachenko even came to Sweden."
"There must have been some other purpose, a secret organization within the organization."
"That was after Stig Wennerström. Everyone was paranoid."
"A sort of secret spy police?"
"There are, in fact, parallels overseas. In the States, a special group of internal spy chasers was created within the CIA in the 50s. It was led by a James Jesus Angleton, and it very nearly sabotaged the entire CIA. Angleton's gang were as fanatical as they were paranoid. They suspected everyone in the CIA of being a Russian agent. As a result, the agency's effectiveness in large areas was paralyzed."
"But that's all speculation.
Where are the old personnel files kept?"
"Goldberg isn't in them. I've checked."
"And what about a budget? An operation like this has to be financed."
The discussion went on until lunchtime, when Figueroa excused herself and went to the gym for some peace, to think things over. Berger did not arrive in the newsroom until lunchtime. Her foot was hurting so badly that she could not put any weight on it. She hobbled over to her glass cage and sank into her chair with relief. Fredrickson looked up from his desk and she waved him in.
"What happened?" he said. "I stepped on a piece of glass and a shard lodged in my heel."
"That wasn't so good."
"No, it wasn't good. Peter, has anyone received any more weird emails?"
"Not that I've heard."
"Keep your ears open. I want to know if anything odd happens around SMP.
"What sort of odd?"
"I'm afraid some idiot is sending really vile emails, and he seems to have targeted me. So I want to know if you hear of anything going on."
"The type of email Eva Carlson got."
"Right. But anything strange at all. I've had a whole string of crazy emails accusing me of being all kinds of things, and suggesting various perverse things that ought to be done to me."
Fredrickson's expression darkened.
"How long has this been going on?"
"A couple of weeks. Keep your eyes peeled. So tell me, what's going to be in the paper tomorrow?
Well,
what?
Holm and the head of the legal section are on the warpath.
Why is that?
Because of Frisk. You extended his contract and gave him a feature assignment, and he won't tell anybody what it's about.
He is forbidden to talk about it. My orders.
That's what he says, which means that Holm and the legal editor are up in arms.
I can see that they might be. Set up a meeting with legal at 3. I'll explain the situation.
Holm is not pleased.
I'm not pleased with Holm, either. So we're even.
He's so upset that he's complained to the board.
Berger looked up. Damn it. I'm going to have to face up to the Borgshire problem.
Borgshire is coming in this afternoon and wants a meeting with you. I suspect it's Holm's doing.
What time?
2 o'clock, said Fredrickson.
And he went back to his desk to write the midday memo. Jonasson visited Salander during her lunch. She pushed away a plate of the hospital's vegetable stew. As always, he did a brief examination of her, but she noticed that he was no longer putting much effort into it.
"You've recovered nicely," he said.
"Hmm. You'll have to do something about the food at this place."
"What about it?"
"Couldn't you get me a pizza?"
"Sorry. Way beyond the budget."
"I was afraid of that."
"Elizabeth, we're going to have a discussion about the state of your health tomorrow."
"Understood. And I've recovered nicely."
"You're now well enough to be moved to Kronoberg Prison. I might be able to postpone the move for another week, but my colleagues are going to start wondering."
"You don't need to do that."
"Are you sure?"
She nodded.
"I'm ready, and it had to happen sooner or later."
"I'll give the go-ahead tomorrow, then," Jonasson said. "You'll probably be transferred pretty soon."
She nodded.
"It might be as early as this weekend.
The hospital administration doesn't want you here."
"Who could blame them?"
That device of yours."
"I'll leave it in the recess behind the table here," she pointed.
"Good idea."
They sat in silence for a moment before Jonasson stood up.
"I have to check on my other patients."
"Thanks for everything. I owe you one."
"Just doing my job."
"No, you've done a great deal more. I won't forget it."
Blomqvist entered police headquarters on Kungsholmen through the entrance on Polemsgarten. Figueroa accompanied him up to the offices of the Constitutional Protection Unit. They exchanged only silent glances in the elevator.
"Do you think it's such a good idea for me to be hanging around at police HQ?" Blomqvist said. "Someone might see us together and start to wonder."
"This will be our only meeting here. From now on we'll meet in an office we've rented at Friedensplan. We get access tomorrow, but this will be okay. Constitutional Protection is a small and more or less self-sufficient unit, and nobody else at SIS cares about it. And we're on a different floor from the rest of SEPO."
He greeted Ed Clinth without shaking hands and said hello to two colleagues who were apparently part of his team. They introduced themselves only as Stefan and Anders. He smiled to himself.
"Where do we start?" he said.
"We could start by having some coffee, Monica,"
Ed Clinth said.
"Thanks, that would be nice," Figueroa said.
Ed Clinth had probably meant for her to serve the coffee. Blomqvist noticed that the chief of the Constitutional Protection Unit hesitated for only a second before he got up and brought the coffee over to the conference table, where place settings were already laid out. Blomqvist saw that Ed Clinth was also smiling to himself, which he took to be a good sign. Then Ed Clinth turned serious.
"I honestly don't know how I should be managing this. It must be the first time a journalist has sat in on a meeting of the security police. The issues we'll be discussing now are in many respects confidential and highly classified."
"I'm not interested in military secrets. I'm only interested in the Zalichenko Club."
"But we have to strike a balance. First of all, the names of today's participants must not be mentioned in your articles."
"Agreed."
Ed Clinth gave Blomqvist a look of surprise.
"Second, you may not speak with anyone but me and Monica Figueroa. We're the ones who will decide what we can tell you."
"If you have a long list of requirements, you should have mentioned them yesterday."
"Yesterday I hadn't yet thought through the matter."
"Then I have something to tell you too. This is probably the first and only time in my professional career that I will reveal the contents of an unpublished story to a police officer. So, to quote you, I honestly don't know how I should be managing this."
A brief silence settled over the table.
"Maybe we..."
"What if we..."
Ed Clinth and Figueroa had started talking at the same time before falling silent.
"My target is the Zalichenko Club," Blomqvist said. "You want to bring charges against the Zalichenko Club. Let's stick to that."
Edklinth nodded.
"So, what do you have?" Blomqvist said.
Edklinth explained what Figueroa and her team had unearthed. He showed Blomqvist the photograph of Evert Gulberg with Colonel Venestrom.
"Good. I'll take a copy of that."
"It's in Orland and Auckland's archive," Figueroa said.
"It's on the table in front of me with a note on the back," Blomqvist said.
"Give him a copy," Edklinth said.
"That means that Zalichenko was murdered by the section.
A murder, coupled with a suicide of a man who was dying of cancer. The Gulberg's still alive, but the doctors don't give him more than a few weeks. After his suicide attempt, he sustained such severe brain damage that he is, for all intents and purposes, a vegetable. And he was the person with primary responsibility for Zalichenko when he defected."
"How do you know that?"
"Gulberg met Prime Minister Feldin 6 weeks after Zalichenko's defection." "Can you prove that?"
"I can. With the visitor's log of the government secretariat. Gulberg arrived together with the then chief of SIS.
And the chief has since died.
But Feldin is alive, and willing to talk about the matter.
Have you?"
"No, I haven't. But someone else has. I can't give you the name. Source protection."
Blomqvist explained how Feldin had reacted to the information about Zalichenko and how he had travelled to The Hague to interview Janerud.
"So the Zalichenko Club is somewhere in this building," Blomqvist said, pointing at the photograph.
"Partly. We think it's an organisation inside the organisation. What you call the Zalichenko Club cannot exist without the support of key people in this building. But we think that the so-called Section for Special Analysis set up shop somewhere outside."
"So that's how it works? A person can be employed by SEPO, have his salary paid by SEPO, and then in fact report to another employer?"
"Something like that."
"So who in the building is working for the Zalichenko Club?"
"We don't know yet, but we have several suspects."
"Mortensen," Blomqvist suggested.
Edklinth nodded.
"Mortensen works for SEPO, and when he's needed by the Zalichenko Club, he's released from his regular job," Figueroa said.
"How does that work in practice?"
"That's a very good question," Edklinth said with a faint smile. "Wouldn't you like to come and work for us?"
"Not on your life," Blomqvist said.
"I jest, of course, but it's a good question. We have a suspect, but we're unable to verify our suspicions just yet."
"Let's see. It must be someone with administrative authority."
"We suspect Chief of Secretariat Albert Schenker," Figueroa said.
"And here we are at our first stumbling block," Edklinth said. "We've given you a name, but we have no proof. So how do you intend to proceed?"
"I can't publish a name without proof. If Schenker is innocent, he would sue Millennium for libel."
"Good, then we are agreed. This cooperative effort has to be based on mutual trust. Your turn, what do you have?"
3 names," Blomqvist said. "The first 2 were members of the Zalichenko Club in the '80s.
Edklinth and Figueroa were instantly alert.
"Hans von Rottinger and Frederick Clinton. Von Rottinger is dead, Clinton is retired. Both of them were part of the circle closest to Zalichenko."
"And the third name?"
Edklinth said.
"Teleborian has a link to a person I know only as Jonas.
We don't know his last name, but we do know that he was with the Zalichenko Club. We've actually speculated a bit that he might be the man with Mortensen in the pictures from Café Copacabana."
"And in what context did the name Jonas crop up?"
"Salander hacked Teleborian's computer, and we can follow the correspondence that shows how Teleborian is conspiring with Jonas in the same way he conspired with Björk in 1991.
"He gives Teleborian instructions, and now we come to another stumbling block," Blomqvist said to Edklinth with a smile. "I can prove my assertions, but I can't give you the documentation without revealing a source. You'll have to accept what I'm saying."
Edklinth looked thoughtful.
"Maybe one of Teleborian's colleagues in Uppsala." "Okay, let's start with Clinton and von Rottinger. Tell us what you know."
Borgshue received Berger in his office next to the boardroom. He looked concerned.
"I heard that you hurt yourself," he said, pointing to her foot.
"It'll pass," Berger said, leaning her crutches against his desk as she sat down in the guest chair.
"Well, that's good. Erika, you've been here a month, and I want us to have a chance to catch up. How do you feel it's going?"
"I have to discuss Vitovaru with him. But how? When?"
I've begun to get a handle on the situation. There are two sides to it. On the one hand, SMP has financial problems and the budget is strangling the newspaper. On the other, SMP has a huge amount of dead meat in the newsroom.
Aren't there any positive aspects?
Of course there are. A whole bunch of experienced professionals who know how to do their jobs. The problem is the ones who won't let them do their jobs.
Holm has spoken to me.
I know.
Borgshoe looked puzzled.
He has a number of opinions about you. Almost all of them are negative.
That's okay. I have a number of opinions about him, too.
Also negative? It's no good if the two of you can't work together.
I have no problem working with him. But he does have a problem with me, Berger sighed. He's driving me nuts. He's very experienced and doubtless one of the most competent news chiefs I've come across. At the same time, he's a bastard of exceptional proportions. He enjoys indulging in intrigue and playing people against one another. I've worked in the media for 25 years, and I have never met a person like him in a management position.
He has to be tough to handle the job. He's under pressure from every direction.
Tough, by all means, but that doesn't mean he has to behave like an idiot. Unfortunately, Holm is a walking disaster, and he's one of the chief reasons why it's almost impossible to get the staff to work as a team. He takes divide and rule as his job description.
Harsh words.
I'll give him 1 month to sort out his attitude. If he hasn't managed it by then, I'm going to remove him as news editor.
You can't do that. It's not your job to take apart the operational organization.
Berger studied the CEO. Forgive me for pointing this out, but that was exactly why you hired me. We also have a contract which explicitly gives me free rein to make the editorial changes I deem necessary. My task here is to rejuvenate the newspaper, and I can do that only by changing the organization and the work routines.
Holm has devoted his life to SMP.
Right, and he's 58, with 7 years to go before retirement. I can't afford to keep him on as a dead weight all that time. Don't misunderstand me, Magnus. From the moment I sat down in that glass cage, my life's goal has been to raise SMP's quality as well as its circulation figures. Holm has a choice. Either he can do things my way, or he can do something else. I'm going to bulldoze anyone who is obstructive or who tries to damage SMP in some other way. Damn, I have to bring up the Vitovara thing. Borgshoe is going to be fired.
Suddenly Borgshoe smiled.
By God, I think you're pretty tough, too.
Yes, I am. And in this case it's regrettable, since it shouldn't be necessary. My job is to produce a good newspaper, and I can do that only if I have a management that functions and colleagues who enjoy their work.
After the meeting with Borgshoe, Berger limped back to the glass cage. She felt depressed. She had been with Borgshoe for 45 minutes without mentioning one syllable about Vitovara. She had not, in other words, been particularly straight or honest with him. When she sat at her computer, she found a message from meekblom@millennium.nu. She knew perfectly well that no such address existed at Millennium. She opened the email. You think that Borgshoe can save you, you little whore. How does your foot feel? She raised her eyes involuntarily and looked out across the newsroom. Her gaze fell on Holm. He looked back at her, then he smiled.
It can only be someone at SMP.
The meeting at the Constitutional Protection Unit lasted until after 5, and they agreed to have another meeting the following week. Blomqvist could contact Figueroa if he needed to be in touch with SIS before then. He packed away his laptop and stood up.
How do I get out of here? He asked.
You certainly can't go running around on your own, Ed Plinth said.
I'll show him out, Figueroa said. Give me a couple of minutes, I just have to pick up a few things from my office.
They walked together through Kronenberg Park towards Friedhelmsplan.
So what happens now? Blomqvist said.
We stay in touch,
Figueroa said.
I'm beginning to like my contact with Seppo.
Do you feel like having dinner later?
Bosnian again?
No, I can't afford to eat out every night. I was thinking of something simple at my place.
She stopped and smiled at him.
Do you know what I'd like to do now?
She said.
No.
I'd like to take you home and undress you.
This could get a bit awkward.
I know. But I wasn't planning on telling my boss.
We don't know how this story's going to turn out. We could end up on opposite sides of the barricades.
I'll take my chances. Now, Are you going to come quietly, or do I have to handcuff you?
The consultant from Milton Security was waiting for Berga when she got home at around 7. Her foot was throbbing painfully, and she limped into the kitchen and sank onto the nearest chair. He had made coffee, and he poured her some.
Thanks. Is making coffee part of Milton's service agreement?
He gave her a polite smile. David Rosin was a short, plump man in his 50s, with a reddish goatee. Thanks for letting me borrow your kitchen today.
It's the least I could do. What's the situation?
Our technicians were here and installed a proper alarm. I'll show you how it works in a minute. I've also gone over every inch of your house, from the basement to the attic, and studied the area around it. I'll review your situation with my colleagues at Milton, and in a few days we'll present an assessment that we'll go over with you. But before that, there are one or two things we ought to discuss.
Go ahead.
First of all, we have to take care of a few formalities. We'll work out the final contract later. It depends what services we agree on. But this is an agreement saying that you've commissioned Milton Security to install the alarm we put in today. It's a standard document saying that we at Milton require certain things of you, and that we commit to certain things, client confidentiality and so forth.
You require things of me?
Yes. An alarm is an alarm, and is completely pointless if some nutcase is standing in your living room with an automatic weapon. For the security to work, we want you and your husband to be aware of certain things, and to take certain routine measures. I'll go over the details with you.
Okay.
I'm jumping ahead and anticipating the final assessment, but this is how I view the general situation. You and your husband live in a detached house. You have a beach at the back of the house and a few large houses in the immediate vicinity. Your neighbours do not have an unobstructed view of your house. It's relatively isolated.
That's correct.
Therefore, an intruder would have a good chance of approaching your house without being observed.
The neighbours on the right are away for long periods, and on the left is an elderly couple who go to bed quite early.
In addition, the houses are positioned with their gables facing each other. There are few windows and so on. Once an intruder comes onto your property, and it takes only 5 seconds to turn off the road and arrive at the rear of the house, the view is completely blocked. The rear is screened by your hedge, the garage, and that large freestanding building.
That's my husband's studio.
He's an artist, I take it.
That's right. Then what?
Whoever smashed your window and sprayed your outside wall was able to do so undisturbed. There might have been some risk that the sound of the breaking window would be heard and someone might have reacted, but your house sits at an angle and the sound was deflected by the facade.
I see.
The second thing is that you have a large property here with a living area of approximately 2,700 square feet, not counting the attic and basement. That's 11 rooms on 2 floors.
The house is a monster. It's my husband's old family home.
There are also a number of different ways to get into the house. Via the front door, the balcony at the back, the porch on the upper floor, and the garage. There are also windows on the ground floor and 6 basement windows that were left without alarms by our predecessors. Finally, I could break in by using the fire escape at the back of the house and entering through the roof hatch leading to the attic. The trap door is secured by nothing more than a latch.
It sounds as if there are revolving doors into the place. What do we have to do?
The alarm we installed today is temporary. We'll come back next week and do the proper installation, with alarms on every window on the ground floor and in the basement. That's your protection against intruders in the event that you and your husband are away.
That's good.
But the present situation has arisen because you have been subject to a direct threat from a specific individual. That's much more serious. We don't know who this person is, what his motives are, or how far he's willing to go, but we can make a few assumptions. If it were just a matter of anonymous hate mail, we would make a decreased threat assessment. But in this case, a person has actually taken the trouble to drive to your house, and it's pretty far to Saltsjöbaden, to carry out an attack. That is worrisome.
I agree with you there.
I talked with Dragan today, and we're of the same mind. Until we know more about the person making the threat, we have to play it safe.
Which means?
First of all, the alarm we installed today contains 2 components. On the one hand, it's an ordinary burglar alarm, which is on when you're not at home, but it's also a sensor for the ground floor that you'll have to turn on when you're upstairs at night. It's an inconvenience because you have to turn off the alarm every time you come downstairs.
Understood.
Second, we changed your bedroom door today.
You changed the whole door?
Yes. We installed a steel safety door. Don't worry, it's painted white and looks just like a normal bedroom door. The difference is that it locks automatically when you close it. To open the door from the inside, you just have to press down the handle as with any normal door. But to open the door from the outside,
You have to enter a 3-digit code on a plate on the door handle.
And you did all this today?
If you're threatened in your home, then you have a safe room in which you can barricade yourself. The walls are sturdy, and it would take quite a while to break down that door, even if your assailant had tools at hand.
That's a comfort.
Third, we're going to install surveillance cameras so that you'll be able to see what's going on in the garden and on the ground floor when you're in the bedroom. That will be done later this week, at the same time as we install the motion detectors outside the house.
It sounds like the bedroom won't be such a romantic place in the future.
It's a small monitor. We can put it inside a wardrobe or a cabinet so that it isn't in full view.
Thank you.
Later in the week, I'll change the doors in your study and in a downstairs room too. If anything happens, you should quickly seek shelter and lock the door while you wait for assistance.
All right.
If you trip the burglar alarm by mistake, then you'll have to call Milton's alarm centre immediately to cancel the emergency vehicle. To cancel it, you'll have to give a password that will be registered with us. If you forget the password, the emergency vehicle will come out anyway and you'll be charged a fee.
Understood.
Fourth, there are now attack alarms in 4 places inside the house. Here in the kitchen, in the hall, in your study upstairs, and in your bedroom. The attack alarm consists of 2 buttons that you press simultaneously and hold down for 3 seconds. You can do it with one hand, but you can't do it by mistake. If the attack alarm is sounded, 3 things will happen. First, Milton will send cars out here. The closest car will come from Adam Security in Fisksetra. 2 men will be here in 10 to 12 minutes. Second, a car from Milton will come down from Nacka. For that, the response time is at best 20 minutes, but more likely 25. Third, the police will be alerted automatically. In other words, several cars will arrive at the scene within a short time, a matter of minutes.
Okay.
An attack alarm can't be cancelled the same way you would cancel the burglar alarm. You can't call and say that it was a mistake. Even if you meet us in the driveway and say it was a mistake, the police will enter the house. We want to be sure that nobody's holding a gun to your husband's head or anything like that. So you use the attack alarm, obviously, only when there is real danger.
I understand.
It doesn't have to be a physical attack. It could be if someone is trying to break in or turns up in the garden or something like that. If you feel threatened in any way, you should set off the alarm, but use your good judgment.
I will.
I notice that you have golf clubs planted here and there around the house.
Yes. I slept here alone last night.
I myself would have checked into a hotel. I have no problem with you taking safety precautions on your own, but you ought to know that you could easily kill an intruder with a golf club. And if you did that, you would most probably be charged with manslaughter. If you admitted that you put golf clubs around the place with the intent of arming yourself, it could also be classified as murder.
If someone attacks me, chances are I do intend to bash in that person's skull.
I understand. But the point of hiring Milton Security is so that you have an alternative to doing that. You should be able to call for help, and above all, you shouldn't end up in a situation where you have to bash in someone's skull.
I'm only too happy to hear it.
And, by the way, what would you do with the golf clubs if an intruder had a gun? The key to good security is all about staying one step ahead of anyone who means you harm.
Tell me how I'm supposed to do that if I have a stalker after me.
You see to it that he never has a chance to get close to you. Now, we won't be finished with the installations here for a couple of days, and then we'll also have to have a talk with your husband. He'll have to be as safety-conscious as you are.
He will be.
Until then, I'd rather you didn't stay here.
I can't move anywhere else. My husband will be home in a couple of days, but both he and I travel fairly often, and one or the other of us has to be here alone from time to time.
I understand, but I'm only talking about a couple of days until we have all the installations ready. Isn't there a friend you could stay with?
Berger thought for a moment about Blomqvist's apartment, but remembered that just now it was not such a good idea.
Thanks, but I'd rather stay here.
I was afraid you'd say that. In that case, I'd like you to have company here for the rest of the week.
Well,
do you have a friend who could come and stay with you?
Sure, but not at 7:30 in the evening if there's a nutcase on the prowl outside.
Rosin thought for a moment.
Do you have anything against a Milton employee staying here? I could call and find out if my colleague Suzanne Linder is free tonight. She certainly wouldn't mind earning a few hundred kroner on the side.
What would it cost exactly?
You'd have to negotiate that with her. It will be outside all our formal agreements. But I really don't want you to stay here alone.
I'm not afraid of the dark.
I didn't think you were, or you wouldn't have slept here last night. Suzanne Linder is also a former policewoman, and is only temporary. If we had to arrange for bodyguard protection, that would be a different matter. And it would be rather expensive.
Rosen's seriousness was having an effect. It dawned on her that here he was calmly talking of the possibility of there being a threat to her life. Was he exaggerating? Should she dismiss his professional caution? In that case, why had she called Milton Security in the first place and asked them to install an alarm?
Okay. Call her. I'll get the guest room ready.
It was not until after 10 p.m. that Figueroa and Blomqvist wrapped sheets around themselves and went to her kitchen to make a cold pasta salad with tuna and bacon from the leftovers in her fridge. They drank water with their dinner. Figueroa giggled. What's so funny?
I'm thinking that Ed Plinth would be a little bit disturbed if he saw us right now. I don't believe he intended for me to go to bed with you when he told me to keep a close eye on you.
You started it. I had the choice of being handcuffed or coming quietly, Blomqvist said.
True, but you weren't very hard to convince.
Maybe you aren't aware of this. Though I doubt it. But you give off the most incredible sexual vibrations. Who on earth do you think can resist that?
You're very kind, but I'm not that sexy. And I don't have sex that often either.
You amaze me.
Really, I don't end up in bed with that many men. I was going out with a guy this spring, but it ended.
Why was that?
He was sweet, but it turned into a wearisome sort of arm-wrestling contest. I was stronger than he was, and he couldn't bear it. Are you the kind of man who'll want to arm-wrestle me?
You mean, am I someone who has a problem with the fact that you're fitter and physically stronger than I am?
No, I'm not. Thanks for being honest. I've noticed that quite a few men get interested, but then they start challenging me and looking for ways to dominate me, especially if they discover I'm a policewoman.
I'm not going to compete with you. I'm better than you are at what I do, and you're better than I am at what you do.
I can live with that attitude.
Why did you pick me up?
I give in to impulses, and you were one of them.
But you're an officer in Seppo, of all places, and we're in the middle of an investigation in which I'm involved.
You mean it was unprofessional of me? You're right. I shouldn't have done it. And I'd have a serious problem if it became known. Ed Plinth would go through the roof.
I won't tell him.
Very chivalrous.
They were silent for a moment.
I don't know what this is going to turn into. You're a man who gets more than his fair share of action, as I gather. Is that accurate?
Yes, unfortunately. And I may not be looking for a steady girlfriend.
Fair warning. I'm probably not looking for a steady boyfriend either. Can we keep it on a friendly level?
I think that will be best. Monica, I'm not going to tell anybody that we got together, but if we aren't careful, I could end up in one hell of a conflict with your colleagues.
I don't think so. Ed Plinth is as straight as an arrow, and we share the same objective, you and my people.
We'll see how it goes.
You had a thing with Lisbeth Salander, too.
Blomqvist looked at her.
Listen, I'm not an open book for everyone to read. My relationship with Lisbeth is none of anyone's business.
She's Zalachenko's daughter.
Yes, and she has to live with that. But she isn't Zalachenko. There's the world of difference.
I didn't mean it that way. I was wondering about your involvement in this story.
Lisbeth is my friend. That shall be enough of an explanation.
Suzanne Linder from Milton Security was dressed in jeans, a black leather jacket and running shoes. She arrived in Saltsjöbaden at 9 in the evening and Rosin showed her around the house. She had brought a green duffel bag containing her laptop, a spring baton, a mace canister, handcuffs and a toothbrush, which she unpacked in Berger's guest room. Berger made coffee.
Thanks for the coffee. You're probably thinking of me as a guest you have to entertain. The fact is, I'm not a guest at all. I'm a necessary evil that suddenly appeared in your life, albeit just for a couple of days. I was in the police for 6 years, and I've worked at Milton for 4. I'm a trained bodyguard.
I see.
There's a threat against you, and I'm here to be a gatekeeper, so that you can sleep in peace, or work, or read a book, or do whatever you feel like doing. If you need to talk, I'm happy to listen. Otherwise, I brought my own book.
Understood.
What I mean is that you should go on with your life and not feel as though you need to entertain me. Then I'd just be in the way. The best thing would be for you to think of me as a temporary work colleague.
Well, I'm certainly not used to this kind of situation. I've had threats before when I was editor-in-chief at Millennium, but then it had to do with my work. Right now it's some seriously unpleasant individual.
Who has a hang-up about you in particular?
Something along those lines.
If we have to arrange full bodyguard protection, it'll cost a lot of money,
and for it to be worth the cost, there has to be a very clear and specific threat. This is just an extra job for me. I'll ask you for 500 kroner a night to sleep here the rest of the week. It's cheap and far below what I would charge if I took the job for Milton. Is that okay with you?
It's completely okay.
If anything happens, I want you to lock yourself in your bedroom and let me handle the situation. Your job is to press the attack alarm. That's all. I don't want you underfoot if there's any trouble.
Berger went to bed at 11. She heard the click of the lock as she closed her bedroom door. Deep in thought, she undressed and climbed into bed. She had been told not to feel obliged to entertain her guest, but she had spent 2 hours with Linda at the kitchen table. She discovered that they got along famously. They had discussed the psychology that causes certain men to stalk women. Linda told her that she did not hold with psychological mumbo-jumbo. She thought the most important thing was simply to stop the bastards. And she enjoyed her job at Milton Security a great deal, since her assignments were largely to act as a counterforce to raging lunatics.
"So why did you resign from the police force?" Berger said.
"A better question would be, why did I become a police officer in the first place?"
"Why did you become a police officer?"
"Because when I was 17, a close friend of mine was mugged and raped in a car by 3 utter bastards. I became a police officer because I thought, rather idealistically, that the police existed to prevent crimes like that."
"Well?"
"I couldn't prevent shit. As a policewoman, I invariably arrived on the scene after a crime had been committed. I couldn't cope with the arrogant lingo on the squad, and I soon found out that some crimes are never even investigated. You're a typical example. Did you try to call the police about what happened?"
"Yes."
"And did they bother to come out here?"
"Not really. I was told to file a report at the local station."
"So now you know. I work for Armansky, and I come into the picture before a crime is committed."
"Mostly concerning women who are threatened?"
"I work with all kinds of things. Security assessments, bodyguard protection, surveillance, and so on. But the work often concerns people who have been threatened. I get on considerably better at Milton than on the force, although there's a drawback."
"What's that?"
"We're only there for clients who can pay."
As she lay in bed, Berger thought about what Linda had said. Not everyone can afford security. She herself had accepted Rosin's proposal for several new doors, engineers, backup alarm systems, and everything else without blinking. The cost of all that work would be almost 50,000 kroner. But she could afford it. She pondered for a moment her suspicion that the person threatening her had something to do with SMP. Whoever it was had known that she had hurt her foot. She thought of Holm. She did not like him, which added to her mistrust of him, but the news that she had been injured had spread fast from the second she appeared in the newsroom on crutches. And she had the Borgshow problem. She suddenly sat up in bed and frowned, looking around the bedroom. She wondered where she had put Cortez's file, on Borgshow and Vitavara ink. She got up, put on her bathrobe, and leaned on a crutch. She went to her study and turned on the light. No, she had not been in her study since she had read through the file in the bath the night before. She had put it on the windowsill. She looked in the bathroom. It was not on the windowsill. She stood there for a while, worrying. She had no memory of seeing the folder that morning. She had not moved it anywhere else. She turned ice cold and spent the next 5 minutes searching the bathroom and going through the stacks of papers and newspapers in the kitchen and bedroom. In the end, she had to admit that the folder was gone. Between the time when she had stepped on the shard of glass and Rosin's arrival that morning, somebody had gone into her bathroom and taken Millennium's material about Vitavara ink. Then it occurred to her that she had other secrets in the house. She limped back to the bedroom and opened the bottom drawer of the chest by her bed. Her heart sank like a stone. Everyone has secrets. She kept hers in the chest of drawers in her bedroom. Berger did not regularly write a diary, but there were periods when she had. There were also old love letters which she had kept from her teenage years. There was an envelope with photographs that had been cool at the time, but when Berger was 25, she had been involved in Club Extreme, which arranged private dating parties for people who were into leather. There were photographs from various parties, and if she had been sober then, she would have recognized that she looked completely demented. And, most disastrous of all, there was a video taken on vacation in the early 90s, when she and Gregor had been guests of the glass artist Torkel Bollinger at his villa on the Costa del Sol.
During the vacation, Berger had discovered that her husband had a definite bisexual tendency, and they had both ended up in bed with Torkel. It had been a pretty wonderful vacation. Video cameras were still a relatively new phenomenon. The movie they had playfully made was definitely not for general release. The drawer was empty.
How could I have been so fucking stupid?
On the bottom of the drawer, someone had spray-painted the familiar five-letter word. Chapter 19. Friday, June 3rd, to Saturday, June 4th. Salander finished her autobiography at 4 on Friday morning, and sent a copy to Blomqvist via the Yahoo group idiotic_table. Then she lay still in bed and stared at the ceiling. She knew that on Valpurgis night she had had her 27th birthday, but she had not even reflected on the fact at the time. She was imprisoned. She had experienced the same thing at St. Stefan's. If things did not go right for her, there was a risk that she would spend many more birthdays in some form of confinement. She was not going to accept a situation like that. The last time she had been locked up, she was barely in her teens. She was grown up now and had more knowledge and skills. She wondered how long it would take for her to escape and settle down safely in some other country to create a new identity and a new life for herself. She got up from the bed and went to the bathroom, where she looked in the mirror. She was no longer limping. She ran her fingers over her hip, where the wound had healed to a scar. She twisted her arms and stretched her left shoulder back and forth. It was tight, but she was more or less healed. She tapped herself on the head. She supposed that her brain had not been too greatly damaged after being perforated by a bullet with a full metal jacket. She had been extraordinarily lucky. Until she had access to a computer, she had spent her time trying to work out how to escape from this locked room at Sahlgrenska. Then Dr. Jonasson and Blomqvist had upset her plans by smuggling in her palm. She had read Blomqvist's articles and brooded over what he had to say. She had done a risk assessment and pondered his plan, weighing her chances. She had decided that for once she was going to do as he advised. She would test the system. Blomqvist had convinced her that she had nothing to lose, and he was offering her a chance to escape in a very different way. If the plan failed, she would simply have to plot her escape from St. Stefan's, or whichever other nut house they put her in. What actually convinced her to decide to play the game Blomqvist's way was her desire for revenge. She forgave nothing. Zalachenko, Björk, and Björman were dead. Teleborian, on the other hand, was alive. So too was her brother, the so-called Ronald Niedermann, even though in reality he was not her problem. Certainly he had helped in the attempt to murder and bury her, but he seemed peripheral. If I run into him sometime, we'll see. But until such time, he's the police's problem. Yet Blomqvist was right. Behind the conspiracy there had to be others not known to her who had contributed to the shaping of her life. She had to put names and social security numbers to these people. So she had decided to go along with Blomqvist's plan. That was why she had written the plain, unvarnished truth about her life in a cracklingly terse autobiography of 40 pages. She had been quite precise. Everything she had written was true. She had accepted Blomqvist's reasoning that she had already been so savaged in the Swedish media by such grotesque libels that a little sheer nonsense could not possibly further damage her reputation. The autobiography was a fiction in the sense that she had not, of course, told the whole truth. She had no intention of doing that. She went back to bed and pulled the covers over her. She felt a niggling irritation that she could not identify. She reached for a notebook, given to her by Giannini and hardly used. She turned to the first page, where she had written x³ + y³ = z³. She had spent several weeks in the Caribbean last winter working herself into a frenzy over Fermat's last theorem. When she came back to Sweden before she got mixed up in the hunt for Zalachenko, she had kept on playing with the equations. What was maddening was that she had the feeling she had seen a solution, that she had discovered a solution. But she could not remember what it was. Not being able to remember something was a phenomenon unknown to Salander. She had tested herself by going on the net and picking out random HTML codes that she glanced at, memorized, and reproduced exactly. She had not lost her photographic memory, which she had always considered a curse. Everything was running as usual in her head. save for the fact that she thought she recalled seeing a solution to Fermat's theorem, but she could not remember how, when, or where. The worst thing was that she did not have the least interest in it. Fermat's theorem no longer fascinated her. That was ominous. That was just the way she usually functioned. She would be fascinated by a problem, but as soon as she had solved it, she lost interest. That was how she felt about Fermat. He was no longer a demon riding on her shoulder, demanding her attention and vexing her intellect. It was an ordinary formula, some squiggles on a piece of paper, and she felt no desire at all to engage with it. This bothered her. She put down the notebook. She should get some sleep. Instead, she took out her palm again and went on the net. She thought for a moment and then went into Armansky's hard drive, which she had not done since she got the handheld. Armansky was working with Blomqvist, but she had not had any particular need to read what he was up to. Absent-mindedly, she read his email. She found the assessment Rosin had carried out at Berger's house. She could scarcely believe what she was reading. Erika Berger has a stalker. She found a message from Suzanne Linder, who had evidently stayed at Berger's house the night before, and who had emailed a report late that night. She looked at the time of the message. It had been sent just before 3 in the morning, and reported Berger's discovery that diaries, letters, and photographs, along with a video of a personal nature, had been stolen from a chest of drawers in Berger's bedroom. After discussing the matter, Fru Berger and I determined that the theft must have occurred during the time she was at Nacka Hospital. That left a period of circa 2.5 hours when the house was empty, and the defective alarm from NIP was not switched on. At all other times, either Berger or David was in the house until the theft was discovered. Conclusion. Berger's stalker remained in her area and was able to observe that she was picked up by a taxi, also possibly that she was injured. The stalker then took the opportunity to get into the house. Salander updated her download of Armansky's hard drive and then switched off the palm, lost in thought. She had mixed feelings. She had no reason to love Berger. She remembered still the humiliation she had felt when she saw her walk off down Hornsgatan with Blomqvist the day before New Year's Eve 1.5 years ago. It had been the stupidest moment of her life, and she would never again allow herself those sorts of feelings. She remembered the terrible hatred she had felt, and her desire to run after them and hurt Berger. Embarrassing. She was cured. But she had no reason to sympathize with Berger. She wondered what the video of a personal nature contained. She had her own film of a personal nature, which showed how advocate bastard Bierman had raped her, and it was now in Blomqvist's keeping. She wondered how she would have reacted if someone had broken into her place and stolen the DVD, which Blomqvist, by definition, had actually done, even though his motives were not to harm her. An awkward situation.